CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, this is Audiophiles. I'm your host, Rachel Genishvili. On this episode, we'll be digging into all things Thanksgiving, from the truth about your turkey, holiday memories we'd prefer to forget, and a Brit's perspective on this American tradition. And we're in for a delicious treat as the band One Ring Zero joins us to play songs off their delectable album, The Recipe Book. But first, it's time for the main course. According to the National Turkey Federation, an estimated 244 million turkeys will be raised in 2011. And the title for largest purveyor goes to Butterball, which produced 1.3 million pounds of turkey for domestic consumption. But not everyone's a fan. This weekend, I went down to Zuccotti Park and met with members of Occupy Big Food. Here to explain this offshoot of the Occupy Wall Street protest is co-organizer Kristen Wortman. Kristen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about how Occupy Big Food got started and what is your mission?
Sure. As everyone knows, Occupy Wall Street has been really at the center of a lot of people's attention, especially people who are activists, people who are concerned with how democracy is taking its course here in this country. And as someone who's always been interested in food supply, and I'm a food writer, I'm a nutritionist, I really saw a really great venue for this message, the problems with industrial food in this country, a really great venue to get that message out there to people who are starting to become aware of how deeply corporations control our lives and, you know, as I see it, how deeply corporations control our food system.
Speaking of corporations, your organization currently has a boycott petition against Butterball. Why is that?
Basically, we decided we were gonna pick Butterball because it's Thanksgiving, and as you mentioned, Butterball is the largest producer of turkey in this country. It's a huge factory farm, and we wanted to send a message to the CEO, president of Butterball, that Americans aren't willing to support a system that degrades our environment, abuses animals, and treats workers poorly, and is really just at the heart of everything that's wrong with factory farms in this country.
Well, I mean, it's good that you mentioned factory farms. Can you talk about sort of the treatment of turkeys on these farms and how the diets affect both them and the people who eat these turkeys?
Sure. So factory farmed animals in this country are generally fed grain, and it's usually a mixture of corn and soy. Grain is not what most of these animals are meant to consume. In the case of turkeys, they're omnivores, and they're supposed to be on pasture, on grass, eating grubs, grass, whatever they can find while foraging around, and that really affects the quality of their meat. In the factory farms, when they're just stuck with eating grain and also antibiotics, I would add, the fatty composition of the meat is actually much less nutritious. So in a factory farm bird that eats grain, it's very high in omega-6 fatty acids, whereas a pasture-raised turkey eats grass and is very high in omega-3 fatty acids. And we know how important omega-3 fatty acids are to human health. So when you eat that meat, it's directly affecting your own health.
You also mentioned sort of the treatment of these animals. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So in these large factory turkey farms, they're kept in these huge rooms with no windows, lights glaring down. They're crammed in sometimes 10,000 birds in this one space. It's a breeding ground for all kinds of pathogens and bacteria. But really, more upsettingly, is the fact how the turkeys are really basically tortured in this kind of environment. When they're babies, their beaks are clipped off so they can't peck each other because they're so crowded in. And they're, you know, PETA has done some investigative work on what goes on actually behind closed doors, and it's really not pretty. I will spare you the details on that, but it's easy to find online. And it's really, really inhumane. Actually, birds in this country are not, poultry animals in this country are not prevented, are not protected under the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act, whereas other animals are. So it's a really big problem.
Kristen, why do you think it's important that Americans know about the impact of industrial farming?
Well, industrial farming affects us on multiple levels. As I mentioned, our health is clearly affected by it, and our environment is deeply affected by it. So we live in a time when factory farms actually produce the most water pollution in this country than anything else. So that kind of pollution ends up, you know, of course, destroying our environment, but also affecting all of our health as well.
And what can the consumer do to have a sort of cruelty-free, healthy Thanksgiving?
I wrote this article called The Truth About Turkey. You can find it on my blog, kristenwortman.wordpress.com, and I have resources there for people, you know, New York City, nationwide, to find pasture-raised, humanely raised turkeys. A great resource is eatwild.com, where you can find, it gives you a listing of all the farmers and all the producers of humanely raised, pasture-raised animal products. And, you know, that's one option. Another option is to start using more vegetarian foods, plant-based foods, start really cooking from scratch. That's really important.
A lot of people can't maybe afford certain organic ingredients. What are your suggestions in that case?
Yeah, well, this is something that Occupy Big Food is really concerned with. We know that too many people in this country don't have access to healthy foods, and they also don't have the money to afford a lot of these pastured or organic foods, which are more expensive. So this is something that, you know, at a deep level we need to address in terms of how food is produced in this country. So this is a big problem that no one's really found a solution to yet, but that's something that we're really working on. But I would suggest, you know, plant-based foods, you can find them in bulk. You can get grains and all kinds of things in bulk at your local store. Buying raw, fresh vegetables isn't terribly expensive. So it's just an issue of access, really. So there's a lot of work to be done on that front, but I think that you can, you know, look for the right resources and find those products, you know, generally speaking.
Okay, and what other events is Occupy Big Food working on?
We're working on our second rally. We just had our rally this past Saturday, which was a really big success. So we're planning another rally with more speakers, a couple of very interesting performers. We're also planning to, you know, we're targeting Butterball right now since it's Thanksgiving, but we're also planning to look at other large producers, factory farmers, industrial agriculture. So we're trying to target different companies one at a time and really get our message out there to people so people can be educated on, you know, each issue.
Besides Butterball, what are the other companies that your organization is concerned about?
Well, there's, as you know, there's a lot of disconsolidation in the food system at this point. So some ones that are really good examples, Monsanto, which controls over 93% of soybeans and 80% of corn grown in this country, and they're largely GMO. We know there's a lot of health risks and environmental consequences with GMO products, so that's a company that we're going to be targeting. Cargill, which is another large producer of industrial farm meat. We have Smithfield, which is one of the hugest pork producers in this country. Just to name this, that's a few right there.
All right, well, that's a pretty lengthy list, but do you think it's possible to work with these big companies and work on some sort of compromise?
You know, I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. That's something that we are talking about all the time and thinking about. We know that we want to put pressure on these companies. That's what we were trying to do with Boycott Butterball, pressuring these companies so that they're forced to really understand that consumers aren't willing to participate or support these kind of industries, and then they can decide whether or not they're going to change their behavior, these companies, or not. So it's hard to say whether or not that's going to really work, or we're going to have to really create an alternative food system, which we see cropping up across the nation already, but we want to really unify that alternative food system so that we can be larger or, you know, at least start to compete with some of these other companies.
Okay, and Kristen, have there maybe been any improvement at all in these types of industries, or no?
I would say no.
Why?
Because we're seeing things actually become worse. You know, the consolidation is even more. It's just a handful of companies at this point. We see what they're doing to the environment. The environment is really suffering. There's not a lot of great opportunities for people working in these factory farms, in these fields. The treatment of animals is not improved at all. So, you know, we have a lot of work to do, and I think that we need to act now because we're getting to a point where it's going to be too late.
All right, Kristen, and that's all the time we've had for today. You were just listening to Kristen Wortman, a co-organizer of Occupy Big Food. And Kristen, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
When most people have a bad Thanksgiving, it's because of undercooked food or an awkward family moment. Well, our reporter Franz Koster had it much, much worse. Here's his memory of a Thanksgiving spent behind bars.
4 years ago, I spent Thanksgiving in jail. It happened in Berkeley, California. I'd been living there a few months, and my only friends were these tree sitters who were trying to stop UC Berkeley from building a new sports stadium in an oak grove. It was kind of like Occupy Wall Street, protest through occupation. The university couldn't really cut down the trees with people living in them, and the action brought all kinds of media attention to a situation no one was talking about. I wasn't involved with the politics of it too much. I thought the oaks were beautiful, but mostly I was there because the tree sitters were my only friends in a new place. I'm a native New Yorker, and I wasn't adjusting too well to the West Coast. Friends were important. The day before Thanksgiving, I got a call from my friends. They had run out of food. Would I please go get some for them? Of course I would. I knew the tree sitters were having some problems with the campus police. I knew the cops had put a fence up around the oak grove to stop people like me from getting supplies to the tree sitters. What I didn't know? There was a court order barring anyone from giving the protesters food, water, supplies, medical attention, I don't know, love, I suppose. So I rounded up a few other people. We got some food, raw vegetables mostly, with a few sandwiches and some pieces of fruit. No turkey, most of the tree sitters were vegetarians. And then we made our first big mistake. We got into my car, a bright red Saturn SUV with New York plates. Not the sneakiest vehicle in the world. We rolled up to the oak grove and put our bags of food on pulleys hanging from tree limbs. Looking back, the whole thing seems ridiculous. We were playing this low-key, sly music as if we were cool, high-tech bank robbers in a movie or spies on a TV show. We drove away joking and giving each other high fives. And then I made the second big mistake of the night. I made a left onto a major road just past campus, and there were the campus police, 5 carloads of them, lights flashing. I pulled over. "Get out of the car," an officer told me. "What seems to be the problem, officer?" "Just get out of the car," he said again. We all got handcuffed and arrested. One of the guys in my car was a law student. He pointed out that the cops hadn't read us our rights. "They never taught you to shut up in law school, huh?" a cop said. The ride to jail took about 45 minutes, but it felt like hours. I kept wondering how I was going to tell my parents what happened as the police stripped me, searched me, and transferred me to a holding cell. "Hey, Mom, happy Thanksgiving. Do you know a good lawyer?" And what was I even in jail for? You see, the cops hadn't bothered to read us the charges when they were forgetting to read us our rights. There was a payphone in holding. I made a collect call to my parents for about $25. They weren't happy to hear my news, but I knew they were working on getting me out. After a few hours, a corrections officer took me aside and gave me a uniform. Huge blue pants and a blue shirt, and humiliatingly small pink sandals. Then he took me to general population, a room full of criminals. There were 20 people in my area. I tried to take a nap, but there was too much going through my head. I had animals at home. Who would take care of them? I had a job at a record store, the kind of job that looks so cool in movies and pays so poorly in real life. Would I get fired? Did I even care? I started thinking about what my family was doing. They'd be just starting on appetizers, but I pictured turkey, mashed potatoes. I thought about my father, an immigrant from the Netherlands, and how much he loves Thanksgiving. I had just started thinking about the irony of being in jail for supporting protesters on a quintessential American holiday when the guards told me it was dinner time. They do have Thanksgiving in jail. I won't say anyone celebrates or gives thanks, but there is prepackaged watery turkey and mashed potatoes that were obviously powdered back in the Stone Age. The guards gave us double portions of pudding. Just after dinner, I heard my name called again. My parents had somehow found a bail bondsman who worked on Thanksgiving. The bail for bringing food to tree sitters? $10,000. I don't remember getting home from jail, but I do remember my court date. It turns out I'd been arrested for violating a court order. No one was interested in hearing that I wasn't read my rights, that I'd spent Thanksgiving in jail without knowing what my charges were, or that keeping food and water from anyone is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. No one was interested in the irony of being imprisoned on Thanksgiving for practicing the right to free expression. Everyone just wanted the whole thing done with. Me too, to tell the truth. When I tell this story, people usually ask me what I learned from the whole experience. Well, what could I learn? Jail wasn't a short story. It wasn't a fable. The characters weren't dynamic. Even after just 2 days in the place, I could tell stasis was the theme, and that don't come back was the moral of the story. It did make me appreciate holidays more. A lot more. Whenever I hear people complaining about how their families are coming over for Thanksgiving or Christmas, I kind of want to smack them. Don't you realize how lucky you are, I want to say. You could be in jail for feeding a hippie a sandwich on Thanksgiving. So be thankful.
And that was Franz Koster on what it's like to spend Thanksgiving in prison. While many Americans will be home feasting with their families this Thursday, the Museum of the American Indian will be open. Visitors can make corn husk dolls, listen to stories from the Great Plains, or learn how to make a beaded octopus bag. Quinn Bradley joins us to explain the center's mission to teach visitors about the museum and contemporary Native American culture. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
What special events do you have planned for this weekend at the museum?
Well, this week we are open, and starting today and for the rest of the week, we are starting our holiday film screenings. So every day at 2 p.m., we will be screening different short films. This week, we're screening two episodes of a television series exploring Native cultures through food called Return of the Buffalo and Bounty of the River's Edge.
So is there any sort of special dishes or foods that are going to be seen in these documentaries?
In the show, it's going to the show really follows the chef, Loretta Barrett Odin, and she kind of on her travels to the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation and the Yurok tribe, where she's going to be learning about preparing traditional dishes. You'll see like buffalo, salmon, and also wild plants such as chokecherry and acorns.
Sounds yummy. I understand that the museum's collection got started with the purchase of a Navajo shirt in 1897. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history?
Absolutely. The New York Museum is named for George Gustav High. He was a wealthy New Yorker who began collecting very prolifically, and actually his collection was about 800,000 artifacts and spanning from North, Central, and South America and spanning more than 10,000 years of history. And that's really what became the cornerstone of the collection.
According to the 2010 census, there are about 107,000 New Yorkers who are Native Americans. Does your museum work with the community, and if so, how?
We do. New York is actually, it's probably one of the largest, has one of the largest urban American Indian populations in the entire country. And we do work with our community. Our exhibitions kind of feature year-round changing exhibitions, dance and music performances. We do children's workshops. We always have family and school programs. We do a lot of tours with students. We have our film festival and video screenings, really presenting the diversity of Native peoples in the Americas and truly trying to strengthen their culture and their voice.
What's the feedback like in the Native American community, knowing that there is an institution that can provide their families with education on their history?
The feedback is really overwhelmingly positive. We have a lot of, you could say, regulars. We get a lot of people who still come, who come to every program, who are at every opening for the exhibitions. And it's not just Native Americans. It's, you know, everyone in the community, like Lower Manhattan. We're really close to Battery Park City. And we're very lucky that we have such a strong visitorship.
A lot of places in New York are derived actually from Native American words. Could you maybe give us a few examples and their meanings?
Well, I think probably the most obvious one would be Manhattan, which Manahatta, mm-hmm. I think most people know is the original term for Manhattan.
And is there any maybe other words or that you know of or maybe that people are surprised by?
Words, I'm not sure. I can tell you something that people probably don't know mm-hmm. is that Broadway, the street Broadway, which the museum is located at the foot at, is actually an old trail.
That's certainly interesting.
Trading. Yeah.
Now, has the museum been interested in addressing educational gaps involving Native culture in New York City schools?
Oh, absolutely. We have a very strong educational program. We often work with educators, holding workshops, trying to fill in those gaps and answer as many questions as we can, and really give educators examples to provide in their own classrooms when it comes to teaching younger students and older students. We also have a very strong cultural interpreter program, which features Native staff members that take students on tours and really kind of explain the exhibitions through kind of a Native lens.
And what's coming up next at the museum? What other plans do you have?
Well, all of our exhibitions, all of our galleries are open. We have a fabulous permanent exhibition called Infinity of Nations that is open, which features about 700 objects from all over North, Central, and South America. Our biggest, our newest event that's coming up is going to be fabulous. It's next weekend. It's our annual art market. It's Saturday, December 3rd and 4th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., featuring over 35 artists from all over the country. They'll be selling jewelry, pottery, paintings, beadwork, all kinds of art. And we're also having a special preview party on Friday, December 2nd, which is a ticketed event. But for more information, you can always check out our website.
All right. And that was Quinn Brady of the Museum of the American Indian. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm here right now with Michael Hirst from the Brooklyn band One Ring Zero. Last month, the band released their newest album, The Recipe Project. The album sets recipes by famous chefs to music. They've also put out a book that includes interviews with those chefs, as well as essays and stories by top food and music writers. This will be the most recent addition to the long history of One Ring Zero's quirky projects. The material covers everything from literature to planets. The Recipe Project is in stores now. Michael, welcome to the Audiophiles.
Thanks for having me.
So before we delve into The Recipe Project, can you talk a little bit about how One Ring Zero got started?
Yes, it's a very long and convoluted story, but we've been around for about 12 years now. We started in Richmond, Virginia, which is where Joshua Kemp and I are both from. The two of us are the main guys, I guess the front men for the band. And we both studied music at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, have degrees in music composition. And shortly after graduating from school, we both ended up working at Hohner, which is a musical instrument repair center factory. It's actually based in Germany, but the distribution center is in Richmond. Mm-hmm. And this always sounds absurd, but he was the accordion tech and I was the harmonica tech. So every day, all week long, we were working on these instruments and firing rubber bands at each other and stuff and across the factory. But that was really where the band started. We just wanted to create a band that used strange instruments and used more of our musical composition degrees. And you know, 8 albums later and 12 years later, we're here in New York continuing to do what we love to do.
Now, how would you describe the type of music that you guys create?
It changes. Originally, I think the idea was, as I just mentioned, to use as many strange instruments as possible. And it was very sort of instrumental, film soundtracky, doing a lot of stuff for dance companies and all that. But then it sort of morphed over the years. We became the house band for McSweeney's. And did an album that had lyrics by all these famous writers. Then we did an album about the planet. So, you know, at this point, I'd say we're very themed driven, if that's a term. I'm just making that up, theme driven. Every album is kind of a different theme. You know, we love to – maybe program music is the right word. You know, so –
All right. Well, it's interesting that you make about these strange instruments. Can you tell me a little bit about something like the melodica or the jonesophone? And why did you decide to incorporate that into your music?
Wow, the jonesophone. You did some homework. So when we were at Hohner, we both realized that we loved sort of ethnic musics strange instruments. And we kept collecting all these things like the melodica, which is a Hohner instrument. At least they make a version. As well as the claviola, which was another weird sort of weird cousin of the melodica that we use quite often. Around that same time, I bought a theremin. I've always loved the theremin. Since I was a little kid, I saw it on some show like That's Incredible or something like that. And so trying to incorporate as many strange instruments as possible has always been sort of a passion. My friend Chip Jones invented this thing called the jonesophone, which you know, it basically weighs about as much as a small elephant and kind of doesn't sound that unsimilar to a guitar, but he made it, so it's cool.
In the past, you've released albums on Alice in Wonderland, even ice cream trucks. So how do you decide on which subject to cover?
for me, it's just very much whatever is fascinating me at the time. You know, with Alice, that was specifically a dance company had commissioned us to come up with music for an evening-length program based on Alice in Wonderland. And mm-hmm. so we thought we should just go through the book and write a song for each chapter. But then in the case of Planets, I just had this fascination. I've always been super geek with celestialness and wanted to do something. And then realizing that it was about 100 years since Gustav Holst had written his song cycle, The Planets, we thought, hey, maybe it's time to revisit the solar system. And, you know, especially with all the craziness going on with Pluto being demoted and all that. In the case of the Author Project, it was just being at the right place at the right time working with Mick Sweeney's. With the Recipe Project, though, it was I love to cook. I love food. And it just seemed like what a fun idea to work with chefs and figure out a way to combine these two elements that are huge passions of mine.
A lot of professional chefs have been in the limelight quite a bit in the last few years. It's almost like they're the new rock stars. How is One Ring Zero addressing that concept?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, you've nailed it. Something that I've also been fascinated with simultaneous to these projects is just this weird – you know, when we were doing the author CD, we realized all these authors were almost like rock stars and they were becoming better known than a lot of rock stars. So we were like, well, why don't we make them rock stars and put this to music and get them on stage with us? And the same thing happened with the Recipe Project. It just occurred to me and the rest of the world that all these chefs are rock stars now. I mean, these guys are more famous than Bono and Michael Stipe at this point. You know, people know who Mario Batali is before they know who Stipe is, even though they're buddies, all that stuff. But it's a crazy phenomenon, you know, with our culture right now. And so in a way, this is a nod, a tip of the hat in addressing that and taking chefs and putting them in this limelight.
Any chef you had a particular joy working with or funny anecdote you would like to share?
All of them had very interesting tidbits. I mean, first and foremost, I should mention that my brother-in-law is one of the celebrity chefs, which was kind of the foot in the door. My brother-in-law is Chris Cosentino, who became fairly he's getting popular thanks to the Food Network, you know, and his show Chef vs. City and being on Iron Chef and all that. So that was kind of an easy entryway into this whole world, and working with him was a lot of fun just because he's my brother-in-law and we both love to goof around and do weird things. In the case of one of the things that makes this project fun for us and I think more of a fun listen is that we asked the chefs what style of music they liked and trying to set the songs in that style of music. So asking the chefs for recipes, you know, we said what style of music do you like and tried to set it based on the style that they suggested. And they were all over the map. I mean, in the case of Issa Chandra Moskowitz, she loved 90s girl rock. So we tried to do something that sounded like the Pixies or the Throwing Muses. And the Pixies aren't really 90s girl rock, but like the Throwing Muses or the Breeders. And we got Tanya Donnelly to come out and sing that one. In the case of David Chang, he loved the Magnetic Fields. So we got Claudia Gonson of the Magnetic Fields to sing that.
So, and she's the punk rock vegan chef, if I recall.
Issa is, yeah. Issa's the post-punk kitchen is her thing. And So she really wanted some kind of, Breeders, Throwing Muses sort of song for hers, which we somehow made happen with Tanya Donnelly singing.
Did you get to sample each recipe that you wrote about?
I have made them all, yes. I didn't necessarily go to their restaurants and try them. A lot of them are not things that are served in their restaurants. They're things that they have in their cookbooks or just in their roster of recipes. But I have made them all. I had to test out all of them before releasing this as a book and CD. So, and that was a lot of fun. And in fact, I mean, the spaghetti, Mario Batali spaghetti with sweet 100 tomatoes has become a staple in my house. We make it all the time.
I understand that the book includes playlists from some of the most famous restaurants in New York. So what's up with the music at David Chang's Noodle Bar? David Chang is the owner of Momofuku, if I'm correct.
Yeah, the whole empire. He's blown up. David is he loves music. I mean, he of all the chefs he worked with, he definitely takes a lot of pride and precision in picking out what he plays at his restaurants. And so that was a lot of fun to sit down with him at his restaurant and talk about music and ask him what he likes to play. And Yeah, he's got a fascinating list of music and a little heavy on the pavement for my taste, but that seems to be the Momofuku way.
So what's lined up next for One Ring Zero? Any projects?
I'm actually working on a solo project. I mean, in fact, you brought up Songs for Ice Cream Trucks, which was not a One Ring Zero album. That was a Michael Hirst solo album. Mm-hmm. And so I'm, you know, I tend to alternate at this point between One Ring Zero projects and solo projects just because I write more than the industry can deal with releasing. So it's under two different names. So the next project I'm doing is Songs for Unusual Creatures, songs inspired by some of the lesser known animals on the planet. And that will be a book and a CD also.
That sounds interesting. Would you mind playing some songs for us now?
I'd be thrilled to give it a shot.
And so what are you going to play first for us?
Well, I'll try the Peanut Butter Brunettes piece by Isa Chandra Moskowitz. And I say try because we normally it's Tanya Donnelly singing it on the album. And, you know, it usually has 15 instruments when we play it with the band. But I will try it on my crappy small acoustic guitar.
All right. Let's hear it.
Three-fourths cup peanut butter, one-third cup canola oil, one cup brown sugar, one-fourth cup almond milk. Vanilla extract, one cup all-purpose flour, one half teaspoon salt, one half teaspoon baking powder, one third a cup peanuts. Preheat oven to 350 degrees. Mix together peanut butter, oil and sugar, milk and vanilla. Stir in flour, salt and baking powder. Transfer to an 8x8 metal baking pan and press it into place. Sprinkle on the peanuts. Bake for 22 to 25 minutes. Let cool and cut into squares. Bake for 22 to 25 minutes. Let cool and cut into squares. Bake for 22 to 25 minutes. Let cool and cut into squares. This is a fade out. Bake for 22 to 25 minutes. Let cool and cut into squares. Defrost the crab claws according to the shipper's directions. Combine the mayonnaise, yuzu, kosho, and yuzu juice in a dipping bowl and mix well. Serve alongside the crab claws. Serve alongside the crab claws. Pounds frozen Jonah crab claws, one cup Kewpie mayonnaise, 1/4 teaspoon green yuzu, kosho yuzu chili paste.
pounds frozen. Jonah crab claws. One cup Kewpie mayonnaise. 1/4 teaspoon green yuzu. Kosho yuzu chili paste. 1 1/2 teaspoons bottled salted yuzu juice. Your hair behind, dare to eat it. Hold the peach in front of your mouth, bite in. And indeed, there will be time.
All right, that was Michael Hirst from the band One Ring Zero. And Michael, thank you for being here. Everyone has their own holiday traditions. But what if you're new to this country? 700 people from 99 different countries live in the International House in Uptown Manhattan. Many of them are about to experience their first Thanksgiving. Rasmus Rand West collected their thoughts on this American holiday.
My name is Josephine Karenjahe, and I'm from Kenya. I celebrated my first Thanksgiving in my college town with an American family. It was the Thanksgiving for one of the staff members, and she brought us to her home, and in her home, everyone brought their pets. So we had about 7 dogs and about 21 adults and about 5 children in the house. It was really crazy because the dogs were running around and the kids were running around, but there was really a sense of that family was really happy to get together, and this was typical for them, even though for me, I had never sat down with that many people and pets before.
Yeah, g'day. I'm Sean Simpson. We don't do Thanksgiving at all in Australia. I know it's something about turkey, but one of my friends, she's invited me to join her family over in Ohio, which I'm really excited about. I don't know. It seems to be pretty much an excuse to get the family together, to just be together and happy that everyone's healthy and just enjoy some really simple things that everyone does enjoy, food and good drinks and laughter. It seems to be pretty much what it's about. I like it. It's a good concept.
I'm Raghav Malik. I'm from India. My sister is coming over from Boston. We're going to get some Indian food like last year. And we're going to enjoy the long weekend, probably sleep in a turkey dinner, blah, blah, blah. How come I haven't experienced it is because I'm usually lazy and I don't like cooking, and I'd rather just sit at home and order a pizza and scream at my non-existent wife.
Something is starting today. Where did it go? Why you want it to be where you know November has come.
And now we'll hear from Rebecca Lee Douglas as she tells about her British friend Alex Watson's first Thanksgiving and his quest to understand its meaning.
I know, it's something to do with turkey, something to do with pilgrims. I really have no idea of what Thanksgiving is really about.
This September, Alex started graduate school in the United States. This holiday will be his first Thanksgiving, which he's spending with my family at my parents' house in Doylestown, Pennsylvania.
I'm really just going to spend the day trying to get to the bottom of this, try and really understand what Thanksgiving is all about.
And so the quest for truth begins, as all brave quests of the 21st century usually do, with the internet.
I just Googled Thanksgiving, and I'm afraid all the pictures that I get are just of turkeys. So it does seem to be pretty important. Thanksgiving Day is a holiday celebrated primarily in the United States and Canada. 1621? Were people in America in 1621?
It turns out that Wikipedia didn't quell his curiosity. And so, on to YouTube.
First Thanksgiving history, myths, and facts.
You see, A long time ago, sometime after the Vikings came to America and then forgot about it, there were these people who came to the New World by boat. They wore funny hats, so they were called pilgrims.
That doesn't sound right. So, this is interesting because I thought that all you ate was turkey, but this Thanksgiving has popcorn and candy and toast.
And the videos of the Macy's Day Parade didn't offer him any clarity at all.
There's a gigantic Mickey Mouse. This is totally absurd. Oh my, there's a Pikachu balloon in this one. Jessica Simpson, what? But it's a celebration, right? Is that why? I mean, you're celebrating. Look at all these amazing things that we produced in America. Look at how cool they are. We're giving thanks for Disney, giving thanks for Hollywood. Is that why? That's how it looks from my point of view.
Alex decided to seek advice from some of my family members. Here's my brother, Andy.
I got a good John Stewart quote about Thanksgiving.
What's that?
John Stewart likes to celebrate Thanksgiving the traditional way by inviting all of his neighbors over for a huge feast and then killing them and taking their land.
Jesus, how do I describe without being extremely cynical? It's such a funny holiday.
And so, with a single quotation from a late-night comedy show, Andy turned a holiday that seemed confusing for Alex into something that seemed impossible.
We're walking up to your local library, and we're going to look at some books. Maybe we can find out something more about the history of Thanksgiving, which right now is kind of a mystery to me.
Still?
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot about food, a lot about America, nothing really very specific. So, yeah, hopefully we'll find something.
Alex has decided to search within the juvenile nonfiction section because he wants a simple introduction to Thanksgiving.
So I found this book called The First Thanksgiving. So the pilgrims are thankful because the Native Americans helped them survive the first winter, which was very hard. Then they invite the Indians to a Thanksgiving feast. And there's a picture here of Native Americans side by side with the pilgrims. The message of this book seems to be that the Native Americans and the pilgrims lived side by side, and everyone had a wonderful time together in America. It seems important that to have this Thanksgiving myth of cooperation and happiness.
Within the walls of the children's section of my local public library, Alex seemed to have hit upon one of the most significant parts of the holiday, the American mythology behind it, this image of a country founded on peace and sharing.
Still kind of piecing this together. To be honest,
there's some people that we can talk to about what Thanksgiving is. Oh, look, maybe the people that are hanging out by the giant Christmas tree over there.
I think Thanksgiving is a time to relax with your family and just have good food and good friends.
It's just the family getting together and eating everything.
And now we're back to the whole turkey thing all over again.
On Thanksgiving, it's a tradition that everybody uses turkey for the main meal. But actually, the main meal of Thanksgiving was deer. Because the Indians, the Native Americans, went out and hunted for the food. And it was actually deer that they mostly ate. And if you want to have a real Thanksgiving meal, have deer and have turkey as a side dish.
So, at this point, it seems that everything has been turned upside down for poor Alex. A holiday about sharing that's really based on stealing, where you eat turkey when you really should eat deer. But he's surprisingly resilient.
So what are you thinking now, Alex?
I feel like we're really getting somewhere. It's really interesting how this is such a huge American holiday, and yet everyone we speak to is so ambiguous about the history. It kind of seems to be confused about it, maybe. And now it's maybe it doesn't even matter. Is what I'm thinking. I wonder if that's just a stupid foreigner way to. So look at Thanksgiving, and it's not really about the history. It's just about family and eating and a
and a celebration. And I think the conclusion that I'm drawing is that, you know, if you the more you think about the history, the less you really want to enjoy Thanksgiving.
So, from a foreigner's not too terribly thorough detective work, we have a thesis for Thanksgiving. It's a holiday whose purpose we have invented, that's grounded in American mythology at best and a big pack of lies at worst. It's upsetting to think that we're ignoring our past. We have been taught so often that it's important to learn from it. And so, I guess it's good that we still have people like Alex, confused outsiders with furrowed brows and questioning gestures, who continue to come here and remind us to really think about our true ideals and to reconsider what being American is all about.
Is that a grain hat? What is it?
It's cornucopia.
It's a okay. Well, good. I'm learning. It's a cornucopia. Okay.
In Doylestown, Pennsylvania, I'm Rebecca Lee Douglas.
As we learned in the last piece, not everyone chooses to celebrate Thanksgiving the same way. Each individual makes the experience their own. Thanksgiving is a time of reflection on those beliefs. And so to celebrate this time, we have two audio essays. Kara Eisenpress has sent us a story about losing her father at a young age.
When I was 11, my father died. Almost immediately, I had a hard time talking about it to anyone. At school, I was terrified that classmates would pity me. I was super stubborn and would never have told the school counselor about my grief. That was what she wanted to hear. At home with my mom and two sisters, there were so many tears that as soon as we started talking about Daddy, I'd be put off. I'd gloss over it with friends I met later in life, saying, "my mom," when they referred to their parents. I never wanted to use the past tense or to hear them say, "I'm so sorry." At my first job out of college, I became friends with a guy named Junie. We would walk laps around the floor to pass the day, chatting on the way to the vending machine. He treated all topics equally. He was always half straightforward and unafraid, half good-naturedly teasing and sarcastic. When he asked about my family, I told him my dad had died from cancer. He didn't say, "I'm so sorry." He told me that when he was 18, his dad had died too. Junie is from California, and what his dad did on weekends was go rock climbing on cliffs with his friends. He and a friend slipped from their grip one day. They fell, and Junie lost his dad. At 22, I didn't know very many people with dead parents, people I could talk to. At work, I moved desks. In a cozy little cubicle alcove, I sat with Junie and Christina. Christina's dad had died a few years before when she was 21, of cancer, too. When the three of us talked about our families and our lost fathers, it certainly wasn't matter of fact, just because we had all experienced it. It's a situation beyond sadness, even 10 or more years down the line. You just feel gypped. And since the unfairness of losing a parent is grasped by everyone, you risk being pitied. I still kept the details of his death to myself, the way the pancreatic cancer blew up his stomach like a balloon, how the doctors wouldn't operate because he'd been a smoker, how he wrote us a letter about the future that my mom read on his death date for years and then stopped reading. But I could tell them about how he was, how he threw his three daughters footballs, even though he might have preferred to be throwing to sons, how he hated cheese except mozzarella on his homemade pizza, how he and my uncle always found themselves at parties on opposite sides of the room, shooting the grapes and almonds from the hors d'oeuvre tray into each other's mouths. Christina explained about her parents' complicated divorce. Junie remembered how his dad had cheered at his football games. And so on. From passing mentions to deeper concerns, we talked about our dads with the same lack of reticence as if they were alive. It was a tone I had rarely been able to find. Our cubicle alcove became a circumstantial, occasional support group. I'm often drawn to those who are different than I am, but for the year that Junie, Christina, and I sat there and talked, I was grateful to be among friends who shared this one sameness. I had found some people I could talk to.
That story was contributed to us by Kara Eisenpress. Sarah Amondeler tells of the time she spent living in the chilly mountains of the Czech Republic.
I believe solitude is overrated. The Czech Republic is a landlocked country, a place where Gothic architecture, Kafka, and beer unite grim-faced people. There's a romance to the place and its unshakable veneer of toughness, a mysteriousness that's intoxicating, and plenty of questions to be answered. How can you make a Czech smile, not smirk? Is there anything to eat other than goulash? Will the painful echoes of communism ever really fade? I considered all this when I moved there alone 2 years ago. I let the country's shadowy persona wash over me. I holed up in pubs with pints of Pilsner, an overflowing ashtray, and books about living off the grid. I pretended to have moved on from Brooklyn and a breakup that had forced me out of my apartment there. Unless pressed, I didn't tell people why I'd come. In the Czech Republic, there's a rich literary history and cities filled with quirky bands and artists. There are charming towns filled with pastry shops and historic buildings. But I chose to live in a remote village in the mountains in the dead of winter. I stayed in a cabin owned by a traveling family in return for watching their dog and two cats and making sure the pipes didn't freeze. They left me a car and a pair of skis and told me to expect lots of cold and snow for the next 2 months. I woke early every morning and filed stories for a website in New York. I sent emails to the coworkers I used to see every day and told them my new home was cold but beautiful. I took long walks with the dog, a boxer who insisted on crawling into bed with me each night. We trekked up icy hills, past houses with chimneys and curling streams of smoke. There was no sun, but I couldn't help shielding my eyes with one hand when I took in the view below, like an explorer or mountaineer would. All this to convince myself I was brave, that I could still move somewhere alone, like I'd done before I'd met my now ex-boyfriend. When I waved at neighbors, their dogs barked back at me, or their chickens rushed toward me, clucking and squawking ferociously. No one wanted to talk, and so I pretended I didn't want to either. I convinced myself the chilly village was giving me time to think more deeply than I could have in New York. By the end of this, I thought, I'll have figured everything out. In reality, of course, I wasn't thinking about anything. The truth would have made me feel even more alone. A few weeks into my stay, an old friend living in London said she was coming to visit. The idea was jarring. Another person would see my mountain home, toss logs into the wood stove, and shoo the cats off the countertops. Someone would sit on the front steps with me and stare off at the jagged treetops. I realized, despite being in this exotic place, how boring my life had become. It was snowing heavily when my friend arrived at the bus stop in the nearest town. By the time we reached the mountains, it was dark and freezing, and we were soaked to the bone, but laughing. Together, we found a Czech restaurant near a ski lodge. We ordered strange traditional dishes while the waitstaff whispered and smiled, offering us ketchup in broken English. To my friend, it was an adventure, a weekend away in the woods. To me, it was a reminder that sometimes talking to yourself gets you nowhere.
That was from contributor Sarah Amandelaire. And that's it for this edition of Audiophiles. Our producer for today's show was Rebecca Lee Douglas. Our audio engineer is Chad Bernard. Production help from Michelle Bangert. And a special thanks to Jesse Hardman and Tina Pamintuan. And I'm your host, Rachel Genishvili. Thanks for listening, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
We got together! Come on!
Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? But I'd been for Cotton Eye Joe.
I know.